As the family gets breakfast every day, but the hotel room has no kitchen, so they order fast food for the remaining meals.
They are used to home-cooked meals all the time. They're used to the native food and stuff what we eat.
Julia Tutak-Stone is Kipnik's police officer and another evacuee. She's staying at the Aspen Hotel in Anchorage, along with her two adult sons and young grandsons, each family in their own room.
It was gonna be like heartbreaking if they didn't come with me.
Stone says the hotel provides them with free meals and snacks. She takes buses to go to the store and to play bingo. And her grandsons attend the Yupik Immersion Program at College Gate Elementary School. Her son, Alexei Ahumkathak-Stone, says
they're enjoying their stay here. It's not fun for me, that's for sure, because it's not my kind of life. My life was subsistence.
Back at the Wingate, Shangin says her family has been looking at apartments already. They even filled out paperwork to receive assistance for rent.
But some of us are tired of waiting.
The family especially liked a two-bedroom apartment they looked at. Shangin says it was big enough for the older children to share their own room.
Oh, my family will be happy. I'll be happy because I'll be able to cook my family food.
Shangin already knows what their first meal will be. A rice dish baked in an oven with meat and seasonings. She says that will be enough for the whole family. In Anchorage, I am Alona Knighton.
More than 100 winter items and more than $15,000 were collected this week during a winter coat drive at the National Congress of American Indians annual convention in Seattle. Attendees brought in new coats and other cold weather essentials, from gloves to scarves to hats. The items will help support unsheltered Native people in the city and will also benefit evacuees in Alaska affected by last month's devastating storm. The Seattle Indian Health Board was among organizations that teamed up with NCAI on the coat drive. Abigail Echohawk is the executive vice president of the health board.
It's really important for us as Native people to come, when we come to areas and we think about how we contribute not just to the local economies, but to the people itself. And so here in Seattle, we have a very large unhoused population. Native people in the Seattle area are 10 times more likely than non-Hispanic whites to live unhoused on the streets of Seattle. And organizations like the Seattle Indian Health Board, United Indians of All Tribes, we work with a lot of these relatives. Having a coat drive really allows us to get some really high quality, nice things out to our communities, both our unhoused relatives and also for our youth and folks who are in need of a nice warm coat in a cold Seattle winter.
Echohawk says distribution of the winter items will begin as soon as her organization receives the donations from NCAI. I'm Brian Bull.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 20th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings and Josh Salem. The producer is Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. A diplomatic row between China and Japan isn't going away. The U.S. peace plan for Gaza leaves Palestinians on the outside. And the Saudi leader visits Trump. Normalization with Israel is out, but business deals are in. First, a diplomatic row between China and Japan isn't going away. The new Japanese Prime Minister, Takaichi Sanai, said that Japan might take military action to defend Taiwan from a Chinese attack in a, quote, survival-threatening situation. That remark provoked the Chinese consul in Osaka to warn that the dirty neck that sticks itself in must be cut off. In other words, Japan should not interfere in what China considers its internal affairs. The Japanese government responded that the consul's remark was inappropriate and that Beijing should take appropriate action. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman made the usual pronouncement that Taiwan is a Chinese affair and no one should interfere in it. He added, quote, "Where exactly does Japan want to take its relations with China?" Beijing defended its consul's remark as a response to wrongful and dangerous Japanese statements about Taiwan. This is no small matter, since Takaichi has made clear that she will steer Japan's defense spending upward, with the obvious intent to work with the U.S. in containing China. The U.S. has contributed to the charged situation by announcing the Trump administration's first arms sales to Taiwan in Trump's second term, a $330 million sale of parts for fighter jets and other aircraft. China responded angrily to that as well. Prime Minister Takaichi is well aware of Japan's close economic ties to China, and Japanese businesses have urged a quick resolution of the situation. We may expect that Takaichi will not say anything more on the subject, unless, that is, Beijing persists in its criticism. So far, Beijing is persisting. China has warned its citizens not to travel to Japan. Its foreign ministry has summoned the Japanese ambassador for the first time in 2 years, most likely for a dressing down, and Beijing has informed Tokyo that it has stopped buying Japanese fish. Japan, in turn, has urged its citizens to be careful when in China and avoid suspicious people. What's interesting here is that quite a number of well-to-do Chinese, as well as some who are politically liberal, are moving to Japan. They are using an underground banking system to move their money. And, as a Japanese writer points out in a new book, there are 5 Chinese language bookstores that have opened in Tokyo, a pretty good sign of the increasing Chinese population. The U.S. peace plan for Gaza leaves Palestinians on the outside. The United Nations Security Council has endorsed the Trump plan for Gaza, with Russia and China abstaining when it became apparent that the Arab states would support it. However, as reported by CNN, an unofficial part of the U.S. plan calls for the Gaza Strip to be divided north to south into red and green zones. The red zone, bordering the Mediterranean on the west, will be left to the Palestinians. It will not be reconstructed, at least not right away. The green zone, bordering Israel and including the West Bank, will undergo reconstruction. If this becomes the formal plan, it is a recipe not just for the continuing impoverishment of the Palestinian people, but also for the re-emergence of Hamas or some other militant group dedicated to resuming the resistance. This news is just one piece of the overall dismal prospects for Palestinians. Another piece is the continuing shortage of humanitarian assistance entering Gaza. Israel is breaching international law by continuing to impose restrictions on aid flows into Gaza, where the population remains critically short of food and life-saving goods as winter sets in, a senior official at the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has said. That official points out that the agency has enough food, tents, and other essentials to fill the equivalent of up to 6,000 trucks. But, quote, "As winter approaches and famine continues to grip the population, it is critical that all this aid is allowed into Gaza without delay. Our supplies would be able to provide food for the entire population for about 3 months. And that is sitting outside in Jordan and Egypt, not able to come in. And that is the case for the other UN agencies because the restrictions and the constraints are still there." A third piece of the problem is the mounting settler attacks in the West Bank, which the Israeli far right clearly supports. These attacks, as I've reported before, are leading to seizure of Palestinian lands and burning of their property. Let's remember that the West Bank occupation is not part of the Trump peace plan. The fourth piece is the resumption of a Hamas activity. Now Hamas is formally rejecting the U.S. idea of being disarmed under the authority of an international stabilization force. Hamas says it will only disarm with the United Nations directly in charge. In a statement, Hamas said it rejects any agreement that harms, quote, the Palestinian people's right to resistance, which would be an attempt to subject the Gaza Strip to international authority and therefore a violation of Palestinian sovereignty. Next, the Saudi leader visits Trump. Normalization with Israel is out, but business deals are in. Mohammed bin Salman's visit to Washington has at least four consequences. One is moving along a $62 billion high-end housing and tourist development project in which the Trump Organization seems destined to invest. Just another corrupt real estate deal for Trump. A second outcome from MBS's visit, as reported by Haaretz and confirmed in some U.S. press reports, is that Saudi officials have signaled that their country will condition normalization with Israel on a clear diplomatic proposal to establish a Palestinian state. Israel can't dictate diplomatic conditions in a country like Saudi Arabia, one official said. Saudi Arabia issued a strong condemnation and denunciation, that's in quotes, of Israel violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. Prime Minister Netanyahu has promised to contain the violence, but once again he made clear that he opposes a Palestinian state. The Saudis are therefore essentially saying that their country won't normalize relations with Israel while Netanyahu is in power. That view may account for the third consequence, Trump's decision to sell Saudi Arabia F-35 stealth fighter jets, despite alarm reportedly being expressed not only by Israeli defense officials, but also by some in the Pentagon, who worry about China's theft of F-35 technology. Now the Israelis want compensation for this enhancement of the Saudis' military capability. The fourth consequence of the visit is that the major U.S. corporations, led by Elon Musk and other leaders of data collection and AI, will flock in ever greater numbers to Saudi Arabia. All of them were at the gala dinner Trump threw for MBS, his murderous past no longer a barrier to doing business. In other news, Israel continues to interfere in Lebanon. Haaretz reports that a survey conducted last month by the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, the peacekeeping force there, found that a wall built by the Israeli Defense Forces crosses the blue line, the de facto border between the two countries. A spokesperson for the UN Secretary General said the concrete wall has made nearly an acre of Lebanese territory inaccessible to the local population. Beirut said it would complain to the United Nations Security Council. The Russians are advancing in eastern Ukraine and recruiting heavily from Africa. Russian forces are on the verge of capturing Pokrovsk, the first major Ukraine city to fall since Bakhmut in May 2023. For Ukraine's government, the Russian advance poses a difficult choice: defend the city to the last to increase Russian casualties, or pull back to save lives. Military strategists are urging Ukraine to choose the latter, noting that past efforts to defend small cities had resulted in unacceptable casualties. Whereas Ukraine has a dwindling pool of recruits, Russia is extending the list of countries that provide mercenaries, particularly from Cameroon, Ghana, Senegal, and Uganda. In all, according to Ukraine's foreign ministry, 1,400 recruits from 36 countries, and that's apart from the roughly 15,000 North Koreans fighting in Ukraine. A specialist on a PBS program November 13th said, quote, "The African recruits and other internationals are helping Russia increase its battlefield numbers. But that's not just a problem for Ukraine. They're leaving their homelands in such high numbers, particularly in some countries in Africa, that it's becoming a security issue there. So many troops from Cameroon, for instance, have joined up that the Cameroonian Defense Ministry ordered its officers to, quote, immediately take appropriate measures against desertion. All men in uniform are now banned from traveling abroad without special permission," unquote. These mercenaries are promised big salaries and duties far from the front lines, but in fact, they are thrust into frontline battle with resulting high casualties or capture. The civil war between the Sudanese government and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces has again engulfed the country. The RSF's attacks and kidnappings have left hundreds of children homeless and many more wounded or raped. Press reports describe the crisis as historic. U.S. officials estimated last year that 150,000 people had been killed and 12 million people have been displaced. Darfur right now is the epicenter of human suffering on the planet. Mass executions, huge amounts of sexual violence, famine, said UN Humanitarian Chief Tom Fletcher. In a remark directed at the Trump administration, Fletcher said, quote, "I challenge anyone who is boasting about aid cuts to come here and speak to these people." Ecuador's violence is worsening, but U.S. troops won't be deployed there. Ecuador is the most violent, drug-ridden country in Latin America, posing, as in several other countries such as El Salvador and the Philippines, a difficult choice for the leader: rely on maximum force to solve the problem, or take steps to deal with the problem as one rooted in economic and social development. Despite demobilization of the revolutionary FARC force in 2016, Colombia remains a major cocaine-producing state, and its political leaders simply cannot contain it. The gangs involved in the cocaine trade run rampant through the villages. As a result, according to one Ecuadorian writer, quote, "homicide rates, which stood at 7.7 per 100,000 people in 2020, have ballooned to a projected 50 per 100,000 people this year, the highest in Latin America." President Daniel Noboa has made clear that he prefers using force to examining development options. He spent a good deal of time wooing Donald Trump with the idea of establishing a U.S. base in Ecuador to help him fight the drug trade. Secretary of State Marco Rubio committed $20 million in security aid for Ecuador. A foreign base on Ecuadorian soil would require a constitutional amendment, however. The issue was put before Ecuadorians Sunday, and they rejected the idea overwhelmingly. That puts President Noboa in a bind. His approach to improving security seems to have lost favor. As an Ecuadorian researcher for the International Crisis Group said, quote, "The honeymoon period has ended. The public is no longer giving Noboa that space or trust. Now people want to see change and results. The narrative of needing more time is no longer resonating." International student enrollment in the U.S. drops dramatically. Trump administration policies on international education have aimed at limiting the number of international students coming to the U.S. Visa restrictions, outright limitations on how many international students a university may have, and a political test for entry. "They must respect our laws, values, and national interests," says a Department of Education spokesperson. All those things have had the desired effect. New student enrollments declined by 17% in the past year, though the total number of international students in the U.S. declined by only 1%. However, international educators consider the drop very significant. The chief executive of FAFSA, the Association of International Educators, estimates that the loss of new foreign students cost the U.S. nearly $1.1 billion and 23,000 jobs. "The pipeline of global talent in the U.S. is in a precarious position," she said. "The United States must adopt more proactive policies to attract and retain the world's best and brightest." Echoing that view, Chris Glass, a Boston College professor and researcher on international higher education, said, quote, "International students aren't just tuition revenue. A decline in international students is not just a matter for next year's enrollment cycle for universities. It's a strategic setback for America's role as a hub of global talent, science, and innovation." In closing, I want to go back to the Saudi prince's visit to Washington. The president of the United States made a remark that cannot be ignored. A reporter had the temerity to ask him about relations with the prince in light of the prince's responsibility, as determined by the CIA, among others, for the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Here is Trump's reply, quote, "A lot of people didn't like that gentleman that you're talking about. Whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen. But the prince knew nothing about it, and we can have it at that. You don't have to embarrass our guest by asking a question like that," unquote. I wonder what Trump would say if someone explained Charlie Kirk's assassination as "things happened," or that things happened when Trump himself escaped an attempted assassination. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up this Saturday is the opening reception of a new photo exhibit called Willamette, River to the People. It's at the Jupiter Hotel in Portland starting at 6. I am joined in the studio by the photographer behind the exhibit, Dustin Pattison. Welcome to the show, Dustin.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. So I want to know all about this photo exhibit of yours, exploring Portland's river culture and how Portlanders are engaging with the river. Where did this project start?
So I'm a street photographer, and I, you know, wander the streets of Portland taking photos of people, and heard about things going on at Duckworth Dock, big crowds on Wednesday evenings. Thought it'd be a fun place to shoot some photography. It indeed was. It was a lot of fun. And started going each week, and got connected to the organization organizing that, Human Access Project, Willie over there, and I connected, and I started doing more pictures of their activations throughout that summer, and then this last summer was my second summer doing that. And so I've, over the last couple summers, I've spent a lot of time on the Willamette and the just kind of the fun crowds and parties that happen on the Willamette right now.
Yeah, it's a growing thing. I'm curious, how did you go about documenting what kind of life is like on the river?
Yeah, it's a little bit nerve-wracking when you have a camera and you're surrounded by people who are just trying to have fun and, you know, in bathing suits and all of that.
Sure.
But as in most street photography, the key is just kind of having the camera out and often, making sure people know with your body language that you're there just to document what's going on and let people know why it's important. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And so I'm curious, yeah, what did you observe over the course of the project?
So a growing culture, I think I would say. From the time I started, even just at the beginning of two summers ago, till now, it's grown. So all the various activations that are happening at all the different beaches throughout Portland's.
Can you explain what you mean by activations?
Yeah, activities mostly organized by either Human Access Projects, sometimes Lloyd Eco District. Mm-hmm. They're actually now organizing the Duckworth Dock events.
And people getting out, swimming,
yeah,
and
essentially,
paddling, whatever.
Essentially opportunities for people to come together and have fun at the river. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forget what that first question was.
Just
but
kind
yeah.
of, yeah, how going through the course of the project, kind of what have you observed
yeah.
you know, with the camera, but also experiencing so much
yeah,
of it?
And so throughout, I have also personally just learned a lot about why people are being asked to enjoy the river, what it means that people are doing it more and more. I've learned a little bit about the history of the river, both sort of early river culture over 100 years ago, what we all sort of like moved to Portland. Many of us moved to Portland and learned that it's, you know, like here are the things, it's not safe. So I've learned why over the last 100 years it's pretty much been sort of an unswimmable river. Mm-hmm. And why more recently it's become otherwise.
Yeah, I guess yeah. Of that history, are there parts of that that kind of jump out at you or that are like the most compelling when trying to like explain the current moment that we're in?
Yeah. Yeah, because I think that the more people enjoy the river and can enjoy the river, that it's actually accessible to folks, I think the more that we see it as a resource to be enjoyed, the more that buy-in happens to stewarding that resource, you know? And so the work that's been done to make it, to clean up the river, to make it more accessible, like the river's edge more accessible to people to actually access the river, enjoy the river, cool off on the river when that is necessary. The more work that's been done to do all those things, the more we see people actually coming out and doing just that. And then, you know, the hope is the more people who are enjoying it, the more people are really caring about what happens to it in the future.
Totally. So there is an opening reception at the Jupiter Hotel Saturday evening. Tell me about what all of this is going to entail. Obviously, your photos that you've been amassing over the past few summers of what, you know, the culture has been like for people using the river. But tell me about, like, the opening specifically.
Yeah. Yeah, the opening is going to be a fun night. So I have collaborated with Human Access Project. It's both sort of an opening reception for my exhibit that will be up for about a month at Jupiter Hotel. But Human Access is making it a party as well. It's really going to be a celebration of sort of what has been accomplished over the last couple of years, especially. And yeah, it's going to be a fun night. We're actually encouraging people to come in swimwear, bathrobes, what have you. It's going to be a sort of beach party in November. We are going to have a wood-fired mobile sauna and plunge pool. We are going to have a Polaroid photo booth, hot dog stand, DJs from Popcart PDX. It's going to be a full evening and fun.
Yeah. A beach night in November, it actually doesn't sound too bad.
Yeah.
I have
yeah.
to tell you. Do you have a favorite shot from the whole project or that's going to be up starting this weekend at the Jupiter?
I do. There's an image that is, it's actually, so I'm releasing a zine on Saturday evening as well that it's focused specifically on Duckworth Dock. There's a photo that I took at Duckworth Dock that is a close-up through... It's kind of a sub-framed photo, so the outer frame is actually an inner tube that I've kind of gotten real close in on, and there are people enjoying the dock through the inner tube. It's actually the first image in my zine because it feels like it's sort of a portal to the dock. Lovely sort of warm orange colors from the sun and from the orange inner tube, all of that. That's my favorite image, yeah.
Yeah, very cool. What inspired the title of the photo exhibit, Willamette River to the People?
Yeah, because I think that is sort of at the core of what Human Access Project has been doing and other organizations, and it's what certainly is at the core of why I'm so compelled to take photos and document this process and this emerging culture, because, you know, the river has essentially, I mean, it was ruined for Portlanders.
Yeah.
By industrial waste and was not for the people for many, many, many years. And so we're starting to see that change. Yeah.
And yeah, and so getting
the celebration
that.
Of, yeah, taking back the river for the people.
And, you know, we've seen local elected officials embrace that as well with the swimmable cities thing.
Yeah. Yep.
I believe it was a resolution they passed.
It was. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Who do you think should come to this exhibit? Who's it for?
Well, it's for everyone. I mean, I think that who we're sort of really targeting and hoping to get lots of folks from, folks who are out there enjoying the river currently. And again, this is kind of a celebration, a sort of summer's over. We're into this sort of dreary fall now, but let's come celebrate what we had this summer. But I also really hope that people who are interested hear about it, maybe don't know what's going on at the river, show up, and I think they'll get a good feel for what sort of river culture is becoming in Portland and how much fun that is. Yep.
Yeah. If our listeners are interested in this exhibit or your work more generally, where can they find out more information?
Yeah, they can find... my website is... my first and last name, dustinpattison.com. Human Access Project, definitely. They're on Instagram, and I encourage everyone to follow them because you really get sort of the latest of all of the cool things that are going on across sort of the Portland's Willamette Riverfront. Absolutely.
Great. Do you have, Dustin, before we wrap up, any final thoughts, any parting words for the people, the Willamette River, the culture, the photo exhibit? Any last words?
I just want more people to be a part of it. It's growing. It's you know, there are crowds out there, of course, But so often I'm talking to random folks and they still don't know that you can even, you know, safely dip your toes in the Willamette.
Yeah, there's still a lot of that narrative out there.
So, and I really do believe that the more that we can enjoy it and get people to enjoy it, it's just going to continue to get better and more advocates, what have you.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, Dustin, thank you so much for coming on to talk with me today.
Thank
I really
you very
appreciate
much.
It. I've been speaking with photographer Dustin Pattison. His new photo exhibit, Willamette River to the People, will be on display at the Jupiter Hotel starting this weekend with an opening reception on Saturday at 6. You have been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO.
I'm Jude.
And I'm Jude.
We are part of the KBOO Youth Collective.
And on the fourth Wednesday of every month,